Right. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming to Elaine's. My name is Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife, Cynthia. This is my restaurant. We're Alexandrian cuisine, so it's based on our family recipes from Egypt. That's really nice to see you all here and to see people eating, too. You're keeping us in business, so thank you for that. We've turned this into a literary salon. I've interviewed over 100 authors since we've opened, and it's really my passion. It's one of I love sitting here and chatting with very talented people and creative people. So today, we have an exciting children's author with us. Karen Leggett Boraya grew up in Cayuga Falls, Ohio, surrounded by writing and books. Her father was a journalist and her mother a school librarian. Karen was an award-winning broadcast journalist for more than two decades. She began reviewing and discussing children's books on ABC, WMAL Radio in Washington, D.C. She's also reviewed children's books and interviewed authors for the Washington Post, New York Times, the Baltimore Sun, Children's Literature, Washington Parent, and others. She's a widely published freelance author and actively involved in disability advocacy in her home state of Maryland. Karen graduated from Brown University in international relations and met her Egyptian husband in Washington. They have two grown children and two grandsons, are active in many cultural exchange initiatives, and have been lucky enough to visit Egypt many times, especially Alexandria, her husband's hometown. So please welcome Karen. So it's an honor to have you here.
Thank
We're
you.
very excited. I've got a lot of questions for you. Why don't we just start off and give us a little bit of a synopsis of what Zam Zam is all about?
Zam Zam is a 7-year-old, 8-year-old boy, and I say 7 or 8 because our grandson is 8 years old now, just turned 8 years old. And he's really, Zam Zam is sort of the nickname that Tharwat calls him. His name is Zamir, and he's some of the experiences that he had suggested that this would be a good children's book. And then it ends up including some experiences that my own son had. So this is the kind of book that is not categorized as nonfiction for the librarians who are here, but it's inspired by my grandson and my son. And they both helped us read together when we were when we launched it for children a couple weeks ago at Politics in Prose. And the impact it had on just turned 8, Zamir, he was in the elevator in my building, and a fellow resident said, "How old are you?" He says, "I'm 8 and I'm famous." And that was a very matter-of-fact statement for him. And he's quite delighted by having the book. And it is a very personal book, beautifully illustrated by Susan L. Roth, who has published more than 60 children's books. Some of them she has written and illustrated. Some she has illustrated. She has illustrated our three books. The first was Hands Around the Library, and then Malala Yousafzai, and now Zam Zam. So this is it's a very personal story. Zam Zam, it's about a little boy who has grandparents in Alexandria and the United States. We use New York City because it's a more familiar city, but it's certainly our experience and the experience of many, many children now, having parents and grandparents from multiple cultures. And he discovers that there are many things that are the same, many things that are different, and at the end, in his dreams, they all go to the moon together because it's the same moon for all of us.
So you mentioned that this is, from personal experience and from how much of it comes from like your own childhood when you're writing for children, because obviously memories fade and we remember things differently. So I don't write for children, but when you do that, how does that like affect your actual writing process? And could you hold the mic a little closer too?
It wasn't so much my own life. I grew up in Ohio, and I had one set of grandparents I didn't know at all, and they were all from Ohio, and as far back as we knew, they were all from the Midwest. So it was not those cultural differences, that cultural richness. I had a rich childhood, but it was not rich with different cultures. So it was really my own children. When our children were young, we traveled to Egypt often. So it was their experience as children and then my grandson's experience as children rather than my own. But you think about reading, certainly when I'm writing it, I'm thinking about reading it aloud to a child and do read it aloud, sort of practice before you actually write it and send it out.
Do you find that when you're reading something out loud that you hear it differently and you're finding things that just don't work? Is it the poetry of the language or is it just your brain processing it differently?
It's both. It's both. And yes, you want it to. I mean, you know that this is going to be read aloud. A picture book is made to be read aloud. So you want the words to flow and you want them to move from page to page so that at the end of a page, you want to turn the next page. So you have to be thinking about that, and you can't do that just on the computer or with your pen. You have to read it out loud, and if a child begins to get drowsy,
the ultimate critic, right?
That's right, exactly. And you ask them, what do they think, and what pages do you like, Samir knew very well which pages he liked and which pages he wanted to read aloud when he had that opportunity. So definitely, they're your best source of information and your best critique audience.
You have your own beta group. That's
yes,
really
exactly.
So it was there a purpose to writing this book? Like, is it like a lot of children's books, right, have a theme or they have a lesson to be learned?
I think the lesson, I mean, yes, but the lesson... You don't start out wanting to share a lesson. You start out telling a good story. And you hope that in the telling of that story, there is a lesson. And the lesson certainly is recognizing the similarities in all our culture and that we are indeed all under the same moon. Wherever we are in the world, it's under one moon. And whether in your class, and you have all these different children in your class, you have children, I'll be speaking to a class of first and second graders next week, and I'll be asking them, how many of you have grandparents or cousins in another country? And I'm expecting a lot of them will have kids raising their hand and indicating that, yes, I'm from another country and so are my grandparents. So it's a very common experience. And I think I want kids to appreciate that it's wonderful. It's not a thing. Sometimes children, there's another book, and I have a copy of it that I can share. More and more books are sharing these cultures. And Nana Akua Goes to School is another grandmother who's from Ghana. And she comes to her grandparents, to her children's home here, and she has traditional face markings. And her granddaughter, it was going to be Grandparents' Day at the school, and she was very nervous about taking her grandmother because she was afraid that the other children in the class would make fun of the markings. And it turned out they really found it very interesting. And they all ended up making drawings and finding out what those drawings meant. So it was a real cultural awakening for all of the children in the class. So there are more and more books that are sharing those ideas. And that's a lesson. That's a lesson that's part of a story.
So this message of like we're all human and there's commonality amongst people, is that something you started with and then went to find the story, or did it develop it by itself out of the story?
It developed out of the story. I wanted to tell the story. I thought the way this story started is one page in the book where grandma makes him a sandwich, peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and puts lettuce in the sandwich. And I had done that for Samir when he was maybe four. And as soon as I put it on the table, he said, "No leaves." and I thought it was funny, and we took out the leaves. And so that was where the story started, was with the leaves. And then it built from there. What other experiences could we include? And it was interesting, the editor from the publisher thought I shouldn't leave the word leaves in there because it's not correct. And I thought, but that's what made it fun.
Right.
So what we have in there, if you'll notice, it says leaves, and then grandma comes in and says it's leaves, not leaves. So we manage, those are the kinds of changes you make with an editor as you're going along so that the editor is satisfied and you don't have teachers ending up with leaves.
So it was more that the audience of children would learn the wrong word as opposed to like a multicultural problem of having someone speak improper English.
Exactly. Yes, it was definitely, they didn't want to have a book that had an incorrect word in it. But that's where the story started. And then at the end, when I was thinking, how do I end this book? It ended, and after it was all over, I thought, oh, that's really, I like the message that's there, but it definitely was the story first, and then the message.
So as an outliner, when I hear you say things like, I want to see where it's going and what happens next, that freaks me out a little bit. So really, it just sort of develops.
So you have an outline for your books.
I outline everything. I have to know how it ends. You didn't know how this would end. You didn't know like the character arc or anything of it to begin with.
And it started out as a very, it was almost little couplets. Each page was just very short little couplets. And we had an excellent editor, Winsome Bingham, who has quite a lot of her own books. And she said, this needs to be richer. I need to know more about how Zam Zam thinks and how he feels. And she kept asking questions, and I answered them. So that the book became much longer, but much richer, because we know much more. Each incident includes how he felt about it, how he looked, what he was thinking about. So we're much more in Zamir's head, in Zam Zam's head, than we would be if we had the very first book. So there's a value to editors as well.
Absolutely. A good editor, yes. So tell us a little bit about Zam Zam's character. And I'm also curious, like in children's books, are there character arcs like you would do? There must be some change, right, from the beginning to the end?
Yes. There's not much change here, except that he does realize that everybody's under, that at least in his dreams, he can see all these grandparents together under the same moon. So he realizes that this is what in the business would be called a quiet picture book. It does not have, there's no dramatic tension. There's not a conflict. There's not, we aren't solving a problem. But Zam Zam is going through each of these days and thinking of what to do on these days. And in some cases, it's suggested by his grandparents going to the camels and going to the merry-go-round. But in other days, he then came home and he wanted to make a drawing for each of his men. He decided that he wanted to draw what he was going to draw. So in some cases, he's making the decisions. But it's not, but in most children's books, yes, and that's true for picture books, certainly for middle grade books and young adult novels, yes, you very much have an arc. You have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, the same way you do for adult books, they definitely have to have that. There's less of that in this particular book.
It seems to me, though, what you call a quiet children's book, right, would be a lot harder because you're trying to capture you as a writer, right? You're trying to keep the interest of a child, and if you have a lot of action going on and a lot of that seems like it's a lot easier. What are some of the difficulties with that, and what are some of the tricks you use to keep a child's attention from page to page?
Well, and a lot of that has to do with the art, and the artist in this case keeps kids turning the pages. And there's a lot for the reader, the parent, or the teacher to talk about on these pages. You can ask, what's the difference between the pages in New York and Alexandria? So when you look here and you ask children, what's the difference between the pages for New York and the pages for Alexandria? Well, the pages for New York are all blue and gray, and you see skyscrapers and tall buildings. And the buildings for Egypt are sandy colored, and you see round buildings that are mosques. So kids can begin to, so you have a conversation, and that's what keeps it going. And then you get to pages with taxis, and you talk about that. That'll be one thing that I raise when I'm in classroom with children. How many of you seen taxis outside? Do you look up from a hotel window or your apartment building? Can you look down and see the cars? And are they tiny cars? That will be something that we talk about. There's also a page in here where we talk about church bells and how many kids have listened to church bells. But we also have the muezzin doing the call to prayer at the top of a mosque. And I'll play that for children so that people will hear that sound. And hear, because in this book, he hears the church bells and he likes that sound, but he hears the muezzin. And the muezzin gets louder and louder, but it makes him feel quiet because it's a very calming sound, even though it's loud and it's all over the city and there are lots of muezzin calling from every minaret in town. It makes you feel quiet. And the kids should be able to hear that when I play that muezzin sound, and then they can see the picture. So those are the illustrations here are so rich that kids can talk about the pictures and what's in the pictures, and that'll keep a quiet story moving.
Does your publisher have a soundtrack available or something, like if they buy the book on Amazon or something, or is there a website that they can go to listen to things like that when they're reading the book? Have they ever tried that kind of multimedia approach?
They haven't. You can get, in some of our past books, I have readings that I have read the book. The Hands Around the Library was about the Biblioteca Alexandrina in Alexandria, Egypt. And we had has to do with the director of the library during the Arab Springs, Ismail Siragodin. And we had him read the book. And so there's a version of him reading the book on the website, so you can go and listen to that. The publishers, they'll do audiobooks. And there are certainly audiobooks for kids. And you can get a lot of these books on YouTube. You can go to and watch other people. Teachers will record themselves reading audiobooks. There isn't an audio version of this book, although we may make one.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. So, you look at it, it's so driven by the pictures, right? And yeah. The prose talk about the picture. So if you're saying and then in New York and then in Egypt, right? How do you do that as an audiobook if they can't see it? I mean, I can see a video, but
you have to
rewrite it, right?
That's right. You'd have to do a video book. Yeah, you'd have to make it so that you're showing the pictures so that the kids are seeing. Picture books has to have the pictures, yes.
Do they do that for children's books, where you have them on an iPad where it's an interactive video experience?
Yeah, they do that. Publishers will do that. They do it more for famous authors than for the ones who are still climbing. But yes, those audiobooks exist, and you can get them. You can probably go to YouTube and look up any book that you've read. Mo Willems reads a lot of his books about the pigeons. There are a lot of those kinds of books that you can find being read aloud.
So tell us, when you came up with this, you based this on your family, right?
Right,
and on your,
right.
on your previous experiences. How about, in creating the names and creating the plot, and I'm so interested in, for people like you, they call them, architects versus gardeners, or people who explore as they write. How these characters come together. Do you at the beginning, do you do a character sketch or something so you kind of know who it is that you're putting into these situations and following them?
No, the first two books I wrote were both nonfiction, so I was telling true stories. And in fact, we were having a hard time in one case with sort of the way one part of the library story should be written. And the illustrator, Susan, writes her own book. So she wrote a page, and she sent it to me. And I said, well, that sounds great, Susan, but it didn't happen. And she goes, oh, some string of things. And then we had to rewrite that. And I sort of wrote it. She had a picture to go with what she had written, which wasn't true. And I said, well, we can sort of adjust the picture a little bit and make it true. So that was driven by the facts of the story. The story with the camel, when we had the humpy lumpy camels and the pointy pointy pyramids, this is the camel is drinking the little boy's soda. And that actually happened. Didn't happen to Zamzam. It happened to Adam, our son. And it's been a memorable story ever since. And so that was, so I knew that story, and I knew that was one that I wanted to put in here. But I added things, and then I'm just thinking, how can I make this a little more fun for a kid? So then we had the humpy lumpy camels and the pointy pointy pyramids, and they resurface later in the book, those terms. And those are the terms that the kids repeat, that even Zamzam repeats those phrases. That was the page he wanted to read aloud. It's the page he goes to first.
Is it the alliteration,
yes.
Or is that something, is there some data on the psychology behind it? Children, when they're learning, right, when they hear a rhythmic tone to the
And it's something they can say. They can say it, and they can sort of bounce around and dance while they're saying it, and it feels fun. And it's more fun than just a camel. A humpy lumpy camel is a lot more fun than just humpy
camels are fun. So when you went from nonfiction to fiction, did you find it freeing that you could just make anything up or do it, or was that inhibiting in some ways because you didn't have a story in front of you?
Yeah, that was hard. That was hard. I spent most of my career as a journalist. I was telling true stories, and it was good for writing picture books because I was writing for radio and everything, you know, was a 40-second story. So I was used to telling very compressed, concise language. And that helped when I was writing my nonfiction books. But suddenly, even though this was going to be a short picture book, it didn't have, I had a couple of incidents, but I was creating it. So that was much more difficult. It probably took me longer to write this book. And then with the editor asking all these questions, what did he feel? And I don't know what he felt then. You know, I had to think about it and really work at and imagine, you know, then I was really working my imagination rather than going to 20 other sources and finding what actually happened on that day or at that thing. So it was fun, but it wasn't what I would call liberating.
So I'm interested in the genre and the differences in children's books, and this is probably a simplistic question, but as I'm looking at the pictures and everything, are there like industry differences between, say, a graphic novel and a comic book and a fully illustrated children's book? I assume there are, but what is that for those of us who don't read children's books?
Yeah, that's true. And graphic novels, I think when I was growing up, they were comic books, and now they've become much more involved. The art is fantastic when you find amazing graphic artists. We have one, Gareth Hines, who is a local artist, and he has done the text and the art for graphic novels of the classics, Homer, the Iliad, Romeo and Juliet, and they're phenomenal. They don't look anything like the comic books when I was growing up, and then our parents really didn't want us to read comic books. These are beautiful, beautiful books, and that's true for many graphic novels now. They tackle difficult, true subjects, and they tackle fantastic stories, and yes, it's a total genre in itself, and much more respected. There are now awards for graphic novels. I'm looking at Brenda. She began the Children's Africana Book Awards. Have you had graphic novels win?
We had two.
Two.
Yeah.
Two graphic novels win very prestigious awards. The awards go to books about Africa, usually written by African authors, but not always. And two winners. So they're much more respected now than they used to be.
Yeah, I know they've really caught on. I'm curious, is there something neurologically different with like children when they're looking at books and they're seeing the pictures and that's captivating them, and maybe they're too young to read or they don't read well, so that explains it. But is that something as you get older that you are just like, is it society, is it a sociological phenomenon that it pushes people more into just pure prose, right? Like even books, you know, we have a lot of antique books here from, you know, the 1800s, 1700s, and they have pictures in them and things. We don't really do that much anymore. I'm wondering, do people, as adults, do they just not like the pictures as much, or is it something that we just got away from as like a trend?
I think a lot of us grew up sort of, we weren't supposed to like comic books. You know, that was, and then, yes, you graduated just like you. In fact, part of the problem is that this kind of book, and certainly our two earlier books, are good for older elementary students, third to fifth graders, but by then, those students are already being encouraged to read chapter books, and they may have a picture at the beginning of the title page, but they don't have pictures all the way through. But that's what kids are encouraged to read. So we do tend to say, you know, the picture books are for little kids, even though picture books really can be appreciated by all ages. And they can certainly be appreciated by the adults who are reading the picture books. We've got several librarians, and I would invite them to comment on sort of how we move from picture books to graphic novels to books with no text.
you can think about that. And at the end of this, I'll come around with the microphone. You can ask whatever questions you want. And if anyone has an answer to that, please let us know. I'm really interested in that.
Yeah.
So what is the age range for this book? Was it 5 to 9? Was that what I saw?
Yeah, 5 to 9 tends to be the other two books because they're a little bit older. This one we do sort of 3 to 8. So this one can be used with a preschooler. You can read this one with a preschooler. And then by the time they're 6 and 7, if they can read it on their own, that's possible. So 3 to 8 is, and I'll be reading it aloud this week to 1st and 2nd graders. So that's, I think, the ideal age.
And how is that determined? I mean, I've interviewed a lot of authors who told me about, like, I just a couple of days ago, I was asking authors, like, what books motivated you? And they were talking about, like, adult books they were reading as children. And I know I was 10, 11, 12. I was reading my parents' books off the shelves.
You
know?
Exactly.
So I'm sure there's a spectrum of you know, people, of children who can comprehend this. How do you set that?
Well, a lot of times it's set by the publisher. And then sometimes you'll find that you look on Barnes & Noble or you look at a bookstore site and they set a totally different age range. So somebody is setting that age range. I think this is appropriate for, I would say, K-8, because I would read this to kindergartners. I did my other nonfiction books with kindergartners, but I shortened it a little bit when I would read it for the youngest kids. And you talk about it differently. Mostly you talk about it differently. But I think publishers set the age range. And then if I really disagree with it as an author, I would say, let's make this a little older or extend it. Usually I want to extend it because I want to encourage older elementary kids to still maintain their interest. And part of the way to do that is to talk about the pictures. You can get into a much more sophisticated discussion with a 3rd, 4th, or 5th grader about the illustrations. And then they can illustrate. They're writing stories all the time, and they can illustrate their own stories and have a better idea of how the stories go along with the pictures.
So Hollywood does that, right? They understand that parents are bringing children to the movie,
right.
So they put little Easter eggs in there and things for the parents, the jokes that are going in the kids' heads. Do you kind of do that here, too, for maybe an older child? You put things in there so there's levels of understanding as a reader?
Yes, and you include some words that you think a younger child might not get, but an older child will. And sometimes they can figure out those words from context, and sometimes you have to talk about that word, and they'll ask. Zamir has been interested in books for quite a long time, and if there's a word he doesn't understand, he'll ask, what does that word mean? I don't think there aren't too many words that kids would not understand in this book. But yes, you can definitely include vocabulary that's above there. What this book includes is some Arabic words. So we intentionally included Arabic words, and then there's a glossary at the end so that the kids can learn a few Arabic words. But the English words are all pretty understandable. But yes, definitely authors will include words that are above the level. So you want to expand a child.
You know, you're writing children's books, it's a whole different world, right?
Yes.
I mean, you came from talking to adults, and now it's this whole different world. Is this, like, when you look at genres and subgenres, it's usually just like children's, right? I mean, are there subgenres within it? Because the subject matter is wildly different between these books.
Absolutely, yes. There are picture books, early readers, middle grade books, and YA, which is young adults and teens. So those are all the genre within the genre of children's books.
And what are some of the landmines that are out there when you're writing for younger children that you have to be aware of? Or you've been doing it for a while, but what about somebody who's new who's started to write children's books? What do they have to be aware of?
I think you either have to remember the child within you, or you have to be writing for a child, whether it's your grandchild or a neighbor. You have to have that child in your head. And I think there are a lot of authors who try to tell a message. And I think you have to think story first. You really have to, the story has to be the most important thing you're putting on that page, whether you're doing it in pictures or with words or with both. Usually authors are writing and there's no connection between the author and the illustrator. That's something that is unusual in picture books that a lot of people don't realize, is that usually a publisher wants to buy just a manuscript and they will find the illustrator. and you usually never, usually there's no connection between the two. In our case, we were good friends before we ever wrote a book, and Susan wanted us to write a book on Egypt. And she went to Egypt and came back and said, the library is what we need to write about. So we went the opposite direction. But you have to have your story first. I think there are a lot of new authors who go out and try to find an illustrator. And I would say, don't bother trying to find an illustrator. Make sure you've got a really good story. Make sure you've got your arc. If it's a quiet book, that's one thing. But otherwise, you've got to have your conflict. You've got to introduce your characters. The characters have to be consistent from the beginning to the end. And you've got to have a conclusion. Make sure you've got a great story. Test it out with a few kids. Rewrite it if you need to. And then that's, I think, the most important. And if you get a message out of it, great. But if they just have fun reading it, that's fine, too. Don't start with the message. I think would be the most important message that I would give to new authors.
It's so interesting that the publisher would like stovepipe the illustrations and the writers, yes, because it's an expression of the writing, right? They're telling the story. Is that intentional in that they want a visual interpretation of it that's separate and they don't want the input of the author? Or is it just coming from experience where authors and illustrators trying to work together when it's two art forms that have trouble?
I think it's a desire to control. I think the publisher wants to control the product. And they have a vision of what they want for this book. Sometimes, particularly if the author and the publishing company have a long-standing relationship, the author can say, I think this would be a good illustrator. I think this would be a good illustrator. There is a benefit to that. And a lot of children's authors will tell you this, that illustrators will see something new in the story. They may add something to the story. They may add something in an illustration that a child will notice that might not be part of the text. And that's good too. And most of the children's authors I know are quite pleased with the illustrations that come. Sometimes there'll be something, oh, you need to change this. This shouldn't be. And we had that even in this. There's a tabla in the, in the book that the little boy plays. He plays a guitar for his grandma and grandpa, and he plays a tabla. And the first illustration had two tabla. And when, here's the tabla over here. It's an Egyptian drum. And the first picture that Susan did had two tabla. And Tharwat was looking it over, and so those are Pakistani. They're not Egyptian. and Susan said, well, I had thousands of pictures from the internet. And he says, yeah, well, they were apparently all Pakistani.
Something was incorrect on the internet?
Exactly. So she redid it, and she still had two tabla. And Tharwat said, well, it would really be just one. So finally we started sending her pictures of our tabla, and that's the picture that you see. And Zamir, when he read the book, he looked at the book and pointed to that picture and pointed to our tabla. So he knew it was the Egyptian tabla. So, and that's the kind of, and we had similar kinds of changes to the other two books as well. So there is, and even if you didn't know the illustrator, if the illustrator included something that was really inaccurate or didn't portray something correctly, then the artist can go and say, wait a minute, that picture has to change, that picture has to change. So there is some information that goes back and forth, but it's just not a collaboration at that point usually.
Are you aware of any developmental psychology about how children, like how much of it's the pictures versus the prose, or you know, like how much, because I've seen kids who are just kind of leafing through looking at the pictures only.
Only, that's right. And there are, and they'll get a different story. They'll get it. And there are kids, those are the kids who, when you tell them to write a story, they'll just draw the pictures, which is fine. I mean, then you've got a little budding artist, and that's great. And I don't know. No, I don't, know much about that.
Well, what is your? You obviously have a lot of passion about Egypt. What is your connection? What are the things about Egypt? And I wish my wife was here to hear it. But what are the things about Egypt that you know you're passionate about or that really spark your imagination?
Well, we've gone many times since our kids were little, and I'm fascinated when I see the ancient Egypt. I mean, it's fascinating. It's amazing that there was such a well developed culture that many years ago. I'm fascinated by the jewelry and the art, and you know, this was 5,000 years ago, and that is fascinating. But part of what we wanted to tell that fascinates me is modern Egypt, and that's the story we try to tell when Thorwald and I go together to children, and that we certainly enjoy, is that there is a whole, you know, boys and girls in Egypt now are not running around in clothes like you see on the mummies or clothes that you see. In fact, Zamir, when he was very little, he was looking at some of the, you've seen the ancient, the mummy, the pictures that are on the walls of the tombs. And he looked in those, he says, well, I'm not Egyptian because they all have no shirts and no shoes. And he wears, and that's true. All those Egyptians in those pictures have no shirts and no shoes. And to him, that was an Egyptian. So we reminded him that his grandfather was Egyptian and he wears shirts and shoes. And we pointed out all the other. And then I started taking pictures of modern Egypt to show children, boys and girls, dressing just like all the rest of us. And the other thing that I think I really especially love about Egypt is the cuisine, which you're celebrating here, and that's wonderful. Thawrat cooks, I've learned to cook Egyptian cooking, and we both thoroughly enjoy cooking and eating, and Egyptians love eating and sharing food, as you probably know, yes. So I think that's, and there's a hospitality that's, I mean, Americans can be friendly, but there's a hospitality in Egypt that is a little bit different. It's warmer. It's more open. It's more instant. It's right there. And when you go to dinner in someone's home, you know, we'll sit everybody down and you have one main dish and you have, you know, a salad and a vegetable and everybody serves and everybody's happy. When you go to an Egyptian home, and the table this long is filled with main dishes and appetizers. And there's just, they so much want to share themselves and share their culture and share their food with you. And I think that's we're hoping to go later this year, and I'm looking forward to that. It's just, it's a warmth that is unique to Egypt. It's certainly probably throughout the Middle East, and certainly Egypt is where I have the most experience. But it's the warmth of those visits that is special.
Yeah, I think you get that culturally around the Mediterranean. Yes. Know, so you get a lot of the family and the group eating and the love of food and coming together over meals. Yeah, I love that too. Do you remember, writing is hard, right? And you obviously have this love of story. Do you remember where that first was sparked in you, like when you were younger?
I was surrounded by it. And if you read my biography, my father was a journalist with a newspaper. He was writing all the time, writing stories, and I would read. And he was writing nonfiction, but I was news stories. My mother was a librarian. We had books. We had books in every room. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't one little part of one room that had books. There were walls of books everywhere. So I was surrounded by that. And surrounded by reading. I mean, we always read, you know, all those library summer programs where how many books can you read to put the star on the top of the tree? I did all of those. I put the star on the top of the tree every season. So it was just being surrounded by books. There was no one moment. There was a moment when I was a journalist and sort of became interested in children's books. That was the editor of the New York Times, when the New York Times had a book review and had a children's section of the book review. It was edited by a woman named Eden Ross Lipson, whom some people in here may know. She was a real icon of the children's literature world in New York. And she wrote a book to help parents choose books for children. And I had a news program on WML Radio at the time, and I interviewed her about, she came as you were interviewing me, and she came, and we had a lovely conversation, and we hit it off. And she asked me to review a children's book for the New York Times. And it was a book with a Middle Eastern, it was a book by Naomi Shihab Nye. It was her first novel. She's quite a well-known Palestinian-American poet, but she had written a novel. And because of my Middle East background, I was asked to review this novel for the New York Times. And that began a long stretch of reviewing children's books for the New York Times and reviewing them on the radio. I had children reviewing books on the radio. And then eventually Susan said, we're going to write a book about the library. So we did. And then I was launched into the world of children's books. And I'm not nearly as prolific as many authors, but I'm delighted to have another one. So that was sort of my entry into children's books.
Did you view that reviewing all those books as sort of an apprenticeship?
Absolutely.
And does your reviewer critic in your head affect you when you're actually writing?
Yes, definitely. I think what will the critics say? What will the reviewers say? Yes, definitely. And in fact, most authors, when they're talking to people who want to write, what's the best practice? Read children's books. Go out and get the award winners. Go out and read authors you like and just read very carefully. How is that book put together? How do they get from the beginning to the end? Yes, that was definitely my apprenticeship.
So writing is one of the few pursuits where everyone thinks they can do it because they write in some form or another, right? But when you decide, okay, I'm going to write a children's book now, was it harder than you thought it would be?
Yes, and it was partly because of the way it happened. We decided, Susan came home with this idea that we were going to write a story about the library, which is this gorgeous, beautiful building in Alexandria, Egypt. And it's on the site or near the site of the original ancient library, which you've all heard of. So, okay, we're going to tell the story of the ancient library up to this. It's going to be a history book. And that's the story we wrote. Well, then the editor got it. But while we were writing, the Arab Spring was happening. And during that time, all the protesters held hands around the library in Alexandria, Egypt, because they wanted to protect it from vandals who might throw rocks. That happened at the end while we were writing. So we thought, okay, we'll end the book with that. That'll be our sort of crescendo at the end of the book. Well, the editor got it and said, the only thing we want is that story. They didn't want any of the history. Basically, they didn't want the book we'd written, but they wanted the one incident at the end. So we were back at square one and had to create not just one page on that, but 42 pages on that incident. So I was doing a lot more research, finding out a lot more, and we created the book. And then we thought, well, you know, I still sort of liked what I'd written about the history. We included a lot in that, what's called back matter. There are two or three pages at the back of the book that give real pictures and real stories of the ancient library, and as well as the protests, and my website. So the website and the back of the book have all that stuff that was written as our original manuscript.
How hard is it to cut from a book based on like a publisher's input or what your editor wants? And how do you know when it's right? And how do you judge, because you're the artist, right? Like, how do you judge, but they know the market? You know, how do you figure out what to cut and how hard is that for you?
That's very hard. And we had, we had some of those discussions with Malala Yousafzai, because we had the first publisher went out of business. But there was still an interest in the book, and there still weren't very many children's biographies of Malala. There are now, but there weren't then. And so we found a new publisher. Well, a new publisher, new editor, she wanted to change some things. And so we, you know, go through page by page, and I said, wait a minute. You know, there were a few things that I really liked. Well, it became a negotiation. It did just a negotiation back and, okay, I'll change this page, leave this page as is. But any of those cuts, once you, particularly if you have phrasing, I mean, you must have this, when you have phrasing that you really like, and the editor wants to get rid of that whole page, you say, no, you know, I'll shorten it, but I want to leave in those words. So yes, it's very difficult to cut. Some of it you can do, it's okay, but those precious words that you worked on really hard to get a particular page, a particular comment. So there were some compromises.
It's the whole kill your darlings, though,
yes,
right?
Exactly right.
And
yes.
Knowing that you can put them on your website or you can put them, so does that help you make the cuts?
That helps, except some of them you want for kids. I mean, there are a few parts of the story that you want, especially for kids. And I fought really hard on a couple of places in Malala, and I won a couple and I lost a couple. But this one was mostly adding. This one we didn't have to cut much. They wanted to cut leaves, and the compromise was made was adding grandma talking about leaves. So that was a fairly easy one to do.
Hey, I think that's so cute. That would have been terrible if you cut it.
I know, exactly. We can't leave it out entirely with it. And I think even little kids get the idea, and they love the notion. I mean, they don't. When I asked, does anybody here like leaves in their sandwiches? Nobody likes leaves. That's not a thing for any kid. Which I hadn't. I learned that, but it made a great page in the book.
Are you continuing to write about Egypt, or do you have a new project now that you're working on?
Well, we're hoping to have another Zamzam book, actually. And I mentioned that to Zamir, and he looked at me, his eyes got big, and said, "You mean I might be a series?" So he's just eight, so he's just realized that the books come in series, and he was quite excited about that. So and he's coming up with some ideas, and so we may have another one that would be perfect for the restaurant, because we're talking about doing Zamzam Learning to Make Kosheri. So we're hoping that we might introduce some. We have a friend who has a kosheri restaurant, Kosheri Corner in Baltimore, and she would like to make kosheri as common in our language as enchiladas and tacos. And so we're hoping that maybe we can contribute to that by having Zamzam make some kosheri.
Kosheri is good stuff, and we have it on
the
menu.
And we have it on the menu. I think a few people had it today, yes.
So I'm going to ask you, I have one question I asked all the authors, and I'm really curious. I get really interesting answers from it. Where do you think story comes from? Like, you know, it's coming out of your head, it's your experience, you're based on certain things, but you're developing a story that didn't exist before. You know, where does story develop? Where does it come from?
I think human beings have an innate need for story. You know, way back to cave people, they were telling stories on the walls, and initially they were stories that they needed to tell. I needed to tell where the buffalo is or where to go find buffalo. So I draw it on the wall. But then we start making up stories. I mean, so many people can remember a grandparent or a great-grandparent who sat around telling stories. And usually it's stories about their childhood. Helen Zweib is here and is an amazing artist, but she has a book of the stories my father told me with her paintings of those stories. She grew up hearing stories. I think there's a... I do. I think we have an innate need, and Zamir he creates his own stories. I think a lot of children do when they're little. They that's not a hard thing. When you tell a class of first graders, write a story. They may draw pictures, but they've got stories in their heads. I think we all have stories in our heads. We tend to outgrow them as we grow older because we think we're not supposed to be interested in little stories. But a lot of us keep on telling stories. You're making up stories that draw on somewhat on your real life, but you put in a lot of fantasy, untrue things that are fun and fun.
You're calling me a liar.
and that's what's sort of interesting is to get kids to figure out, you know, what's a lie and what's just in your imagination as a story. But I think we need story. We need story to grow as human beings.
Do you find that writing children's books has brought you back to, has it like brought back memories from your own childhood, or has it brought you back to an earlier version of yourself in some ways because you're writing for that age?
Mostly, yes. And I do think of my own childhood, and because I do remember my parents reading to me and reading to my children. So yes, it's very nice memories.
That's wonderful. Okay, I'm going to come around and I'll bring the microphone. Just hold it close so we want to pick up the questions on the video. Do you have any questions? What was that question you had earlier that you said somebody...
It was about graphic novels.
Yes,
and sort of how did graphic novels move from being comic books to being respected literature?
Can anybody answer that? Okay. Sure.
When we first started receiving books that were graphic novels, I think, oh, I'll do this. This is a comic book. No. Because you have to, and the artists are so clever because they can lead you from one part to another. That kind of happens automatically in your head, but that has to be very skillfully done. And it just takes a lot of thinking. That's what I found. I was thinking more and deeper and I just fell in love with graphic novels because it's not just a comic book.
And you grew up not reading graphic novels or comic books, probably, right? Yeah.
Yes.
So many things I want to email to Karen. But you asked about developmental. I'm an educator.
And a psychologist.
We say when we're young, we learn to read. And then when we're older, we read to learn. And that transition that you see in children is fascinating. The other just thing, which would be a whole nother afternoon, is that when we're little, the areas of our brain that lights up when we're learning is in the language center. And we read word, 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 word. As we become fluent readers, the area that's activated is the vision center because we can just see it and it immediately goes from vision into our language centers. So the whole graphic novel piece is really interesting, too, because of there's many readers who never become fluent in graphic novels. You know, in my career, that was something I always encouraged kids to read if they couldn't do the word-to-word-to-word piece, if they were struggling with that. So I'm just delighted that it's available to all of us now.
And there are graphic novels for adults. There are a number of graphic novels that are very wonderfully done for adults.
Other questions?
About picture books. And I was a high school librarian, middle school librarian, and you know, all ages basically. But you know, people think that that's for the little kids, as Karen was saying. So I would often use them in middle school because, you know, maybe it's a simpler story for a younger child, but then you can kind of deconstruct the story more when you get to middle school. I can't remember the guy who was the king of Jeopardy, the young guy who knew everything, and he was going to remember his name. And so somebody asked him once, how did he get, you know, prepare himself? He said, I read picture books. And he would go to the library, and that's how he increased his knowledge. And when I was a very young librarian working in Brookline, Massachusetts, that's when I kind of realized that picture books, the vocabulary was so elevated. I was learning... I improved my vocabulary so much because I had to, you know, pronounce these words. And so picture books are wonderful for all ages. Yeah.
And I think also, I think a lot of people aren't aware how much research goes into a picture book. If they're a nonfiction book, I mean, certainly we did a ton of research, both for Malala as well, and in even more the library in Alexandria, but even fiction, if you're, I will see children's authors on Facebook asking a question, what do fifth graders call this? You know, because they're looking for parents of fifth graders or fifth graders who can say this is what your research now is everywhere. It's online, it's with people, but there's a lot of research that goes into making sure that you're reflecting accurately, whether it's a true story or an imagined story, that you're reflecting the culture, the clothing, everything accurately and carefully.
Any last questions? Okay, so where can readers find you?
Uh, The website is KarenLeggettAbaraya.com. I have Instagram and Facebook, same names. The books are particularly with Barnes & Noble. Today you can get them, also Bookshop, where we urge people to look for the books.
All right, yeah, so Barnes & Noble's in the room in the back there, so if you could support them, we'd really appreciate it, too. They come out and support a lot of our authors, so let's make it worth their while. I have two asks for you besides that. If you like Karen's work, if you could just jump onto Amazon and give her a 5-star rating, it would really help. If everyone here did it, it would give her a nice little bump in the algorithm, and people would be able to see her books more readily, too. And if you do the same for Elaine's with Open Table or Yelp or Google or wherever it is you rate restaurants, we'd really appreciate it. We're all word of mouth, so every little bit helps. Karen's been really lovely. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you for all of you for coming. We've mixed up people from all of my worlds, and I've loved having you meet each other and see you all together. So thank you very much to every one of you for coming.